I have to speak very quickly, so please try to stay with me. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. I'm a writer, I'm a blogger, I'm a movie maker, I'm a troublemaker. I have been doing some extensive writing and work on this crisis. I made a film, In Debt We Trust, which basically warned of this credit crisis. I followed up with a book called Plunder, which is investigating our economic calamity, and I've written a new book called The Crime of Our Time, which is about the way in which the financial crisis is a crime story. Barbara Kelly, raise your hand. She has some of my books here if anyone's interested. That's the end of the commercial part of this presentation. We are in a crisis here, and it's appropriate that we're meeting in a third grade room because a group of French scholars trying to understand how did the United States get into this mess came to the realization, I think not very difficult, that financial literacy in this country is at a very low level, perhaps even lower than in many third world countries. As a consequence, people don't learn much about money, they don't want to talk about money and all the rest of it. I went into a room at the Rochester Institute of Technology. I asked this question: how many of you in this room, 1,500 students, are in debt? No hands went up. I then asked the question, how many of you in this room know somebody in debt, with debt? Every hand went up. And then they started talking about, I'm 10,000 in debt, I'm 20,000, I'm 30,000, on and upward to the winner who was $140,000 in debt. So this speaks to a change, a transformation, a transition of our own economy, an economy that made things became an economy that sold things. Production became replaced by consumption. Jobs outsourced to low-wage countries in order to help juice this particular economic transition. Real wages in America frozen at 1971 levels. So we have a situation where financial engineering and re-engineering took place. This didn't just happen one afternoon out of the blue. This is a logical or illogical consequence of an illogical system, or a system that was designed to profit the few and to involve the massive transfer of wealth from working people and middle class people to wealthy people in America. We've seen that social stratification has increased, inequality has deepened in America almost to really obscene levels. So when we look at this context, we have to put it in a context, and that's the economic context here. And this is done really according to various strategies that were actually designed and enacted about how to retool our economy and re-energize it. Of course, they used language that obscured it. Example, reading now from Nouriel Roubini, one of the first economists at NYU really to predict this whole crisis. Stay with me. First, you take a bunch of shaky and risky subprime mortgages and repackage them into residential mortgage-backed securities, RMBS. Then you repackage these RMBSs in different equity mezzanine senior tranches of cash CDOs that receive a misleading investment grade rating by credit rating agencies. Then you create synthetic CDOs out of the same underlying RMBSs. Are you following me? Because there will be a quiz here, okay? Then you create CDOs of CDOs, or squared CDOs out of those CDOs, and then you create cubed CDOs out of the same murky securities. Then you stuff some of these RMBSs and CDO tranches into SIVs, which are structured investment vehicles, or into ABCPs, got it? Which are asset-backed commercial paper, or into money market funds. Then no wonder that eventually people panic and they start talking about these investments as toxic waste because there are no underlying assets beneath these assets. So you combine an opaque and unregulated global financial system where moderate levels of leverage by individual investors pile up into leverage ratios of 100 plus. Add to this toxic mix investments in uncertain, obscure, misrated, mispriced, complex, esoteric credit derivatives, CDOs of CDOs of CDOs, and the entire other alphabet of credit instruments that no investor can properly price. then you have created, in the words of this professor, a financial monster. And it is this monster which is obscured by all of these specific designated financial instruments and esoteric devices, which, you know, basically came to a point where there were no assets basically behind the assets. And these different CDOs and SIVs were being resold all around the world to banks with the credit rating, that a AAA rating that suggested that it had value. And then suddenly they discovered they had no value. They had bought, in a sense, the equivalent of infected peanuts that are being sold, you know, by China in America. Things that claimed to be one thing but were actually something else. And so the market began to crumble. Confidence froze. Credit froze. And we're here today with a completely reshaped Wall Street, where two of the big investment houses, Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, went down, where others reorganized themselves as bank holding companies, not just Goldman Sachs, but also American Express and Visa and MasterCard and a whole bunch of others. Walmart began to get into the banking business, because the profits of the banking business, of the financialized part of our economy, was greater than the profits of actually making things. So it's easier to invest in money than in the market, actually. You can make more money from money. And this is where paper took over. It's all very complicated, but it's all very simple, ultimately. A few people, a relatively small number of people, ended up, okay, making a fortune. And as Graydon Carter, the editor of Vanity Fair, said, this may turn out to be the greatest nonviolent crime against humanity in history. Never before have so few done so much to so many. So in analyzing all of this, we need to abandon the strictly supposedly neutral and objective economic framework and put this in a deeper political and moral framework. And what we end up with are 14 million families losing their homes, 10% unemployment in real, but actually 20% of people actually being told that there will be no stability in this economy, no real change for at least 7 years. So this is a crisis which is getting deeper and deeper. At the same time, most people, including many progressives, don't have a clue about this. They think that if you're not in the market, I'm not an investor, I'm a school teacher, therefore I'm not going to be affected by this. It's not me, it's someone else that's going to be affected, until they find out that they've lost 40%, or in some instances, all of their retirement funds. That their entire futures have been, in a sense, mortgaged, even if they didn't have these mortgage securities. And now suddenly people are scratching their head and trying to figure out what to do. And for many, it's too late, because the deed has been done, the money is gone, and the people who made the money, are off living either as Bernard Madoff is in a federal prison, or they're living, you know, in luxury on some island in the Caribbean, having, you know, put a lot of their money into, offshore facilities. And we had the situation where the United States was trying to get the names and the accounts of 50,000 initially Americans who have accounts in UBS and other banks. UBS, incidentally, the vice president of this bank was a fellow by the name of Phil Graham, former Democrat turned Republican, who actually introduced this financial, this Commodity Modernization Act in the Senate, and has been a point player in all this, rewarded with a vice presidency at this Swiss bank. What I'm suggesting to you is that none of this will be changed unless we have what amounts to a Pecora-style investigation. Pecora was after the Depression. Franklin Roosevelt appointed him to do this commission. Unlike the phony 9/11 commission, this was a real independent commission that investigated this and actually put its finger on all kinds of financial scams and frauds that actually drove this crisis. So we need an investigation immediately. B, we need prosecution and investigations of wrongdoers, because as long as these people are rewarded for having stolen all this money, there will be no confidence among the American people that anything can be done about it. So we need not just a bailout, but a jailout. And this is what I've argued for in my film, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time, which I hope, if you're interested, you can help me arrange the show in your communities, because we have to start a national discussion about this. There are organizations that have been that are new on the scene, an organization called anewwayforward.org. This is a group that's proposing and working on all kinds of financial reform ideas. The idea being that if a bank is too big to fail, it's too big to exist. And therefore, we have to regulate all of this. So our approach to all of this really is, we have to educate ourselves. We have to arm ourselves with information about what's happening here, how this could have happened, and what the impacts of it are. Two, we need to relieve and help the people who are struggling to survive right now. And these people include not only, you know, the wealthy, but students who are graduating with gigantic, you know, burdens of loans. And in essence, for them, the economy has moved not towards capitalism that's failing, but towards feudalism, okay, towards serfdom, where they're actually tied to their debts the way, you know, under serfdom, the serfs were tied to the land. So we have to try to find ways to relieve all of this with debt relief by rolling back the rates and interest rates. Banks pay 0% or 1% for money. Students pay 9, 10, 11% for money. That has to end, and we can help end that. So we need an agenda for change. Then we need to actually educate each other about this problem. And I've been arguing this, you know, not just you know, with the media, which actually was a co-conspirator in this whole thing by not exposing it, not informing us about it, and actually promoting a lot of these financial products. You know, between 2002 and 2007, there was $3.5 billion in advertising in cable and internet and newspapers by dodgy lenders and credit card companies. So they've actually maintained an offensive of misinformation and deception about all of this. That has to stop, and that has to change. And right now there's a proposal by the Obama administration for a credit, a consumer protection agency, which they want as their financial reform. The Fed says, no, you don't need that, we'll handle it. The same Federal Reserve Bank that did nothing to stop this, when people were warning, including one of the Fed's own governors, Mr. Gramlich, was warning, you know, that these subprime loans would lead to an implosion. He wasn't listened to. Alan Greenspan, the genius, you know, who was praised to the skies, was deeply, you know, complicit in all of this, et cetera, and so forth. I'm trying to simplify here, but there were three rings to the crisis. We have to think of it as a three-ring circus. One, mortgages. 80% of the mortgages are fraudulent. The FBI has called mortgage fraud an epidemic in America. They're talking about 500,000, 700,000, a million complaints from people who were, you know, basically talked into deceptive loans. It's very easy. What's your name?
Roberta,
wouldn't you like a new house, Roberta, with a pool? I can't afford it. Oh, come on, Roberta, we can work it out. You know, the value of the property will go up. You can take out equity. You can flip it. Everybody wins. It's a win-win situation. Besides, your cousin Herbie bought a house from us. Oh, he did, really? That's where he got the nice house from. So, in other words, that logic kind of connected to a lot of people. Who were living in many cases.
Are you sure you didn't do that for a living for a while?
Many cases, many cases living on credit cards to supplement their income. So all of this is part of the situation. First, the mortgages and the mortgage fraud. Then the second part of it was predatory securitization, where Wall Street firms were turning these mortgages, buying them back, and turning them into these bundles and selling them to anybody who would buy them, again, saying, look, real estate has only gone up in America, it never goes down, this is a safe bet, these homes are going to be here forever, blah, 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 and people bought this. And the third part of this, the third ring in the circus, was the insurance companies, the insurers, the AIGs, and the credit default swap people and all the rest of it, who basically helped these speculators gamble against their own investments to protect them, because they knew that that there would be defaults, that people couldn't afford all this. The idea was structuring mortgages to fail, designing them to fail. And this was an industry. This was not just a few individuals. We're talking about, 100,000 people out of work on Wall Street today. What do you think they did before? Okay? They were part of this machine. And unless we understand it as that, we all know about the military-industrial complex, but we don't really think about the credit and finance complex, which may in many ways may even be bigger and more global and more dangerous. So my whole reason for wanting to be on the panel, I'm going to end now, is to basically urge us to take on this issue. If not the left, who? If not progressives who care about the living standards and the livelihoods of people, who else is going to take this on? And we're not doing it. We're not learning about it. We need to start. And I urge you, not just in a self-interested way, but to try to find out as much as you can. There are some terrific financial blogs you can read. Naked Capitalism is one of them. BaselineScenario.com is another one. My News Dissector blog every day features what I consider the best reports from the best of these blogs. To try to educate ourselves about these issues so that we can then take some political action about it. And if you can help me in this, I really appreciate it, because I'm trying to get these books out. I've been doing a film on the financial crisis with a financial crisis myself. And it's not easy to do. I don't have the backing of John Malone, who Al Gore called the Darth Vader of cable, who is the funder, his company is distributing Michael Moore's movie, which is good, and one of the many contradictions in our world. But he's smarter than I am in being able to attract this funding. But we need help in getting this stuff out, and we need your involvement, your interest, and your willingness to act. Thank you.
It's hard to explain how it is that all of these securitized mortgage instruments could have become as toxic as they did. Because the truth of the matter is that only 20% of the mortgages are in arrears. Or that means 80% of this stuff should have been good. So, yes, we would have had a crisis. It would have been problematic. But none of this, the actual defaults on the mortgages, should never, ever have led to what finally, it's only because we had unsustainable macroeconomic imbalances in the first place. It's only because prudent regulation of the banking industry, dating back to the Great Depression, had been systematically dismantled under pressure from the financial industry. It's only because people like Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner actively intervened to prevent regulation of highly speculative Wall Street investment banks and hedge funds, the kind of thing that Eric was talking about. Only because all those things happened did we get the worst financial crisis in 80 years out of the bursting of a housing bubble that had to burst at some point, and the bursting really was a 20% default rate. So the question is, when you take all of these mortgages, 20% of which are bad, how do you create a toxic soup that somehow, sinks the ship? They took these mortgages and chopped them up into little tiny itty-bitty pieces. And then they put them together, as Danny was explaining, over and over and over again. They basically packaged and repackaged and repackaged and repackaged. Now, their story about this was, we are managing risk in a smarter way. We're spreading out risk, which basically makes everything less risky. That was the story that they sold, that the industry sold. The financial economists and the economic profession helped them sell that story. If you look at the actual, what was taught in financial economic classes It was essentially, this is, you know, the brilliant new way of sort of spreading risk in order to manage risk better. What nobody actually noticed at the time was they were so clever that they were actually successfully hiding where the risk was rather than spreading it. When they chop these things up, on average, 80% of it's good. The underlying part, on average, at least in the original default on the houses, 80% of it was good and only 20% of it was bad. Aha. But when they chop them all up and put them into little ECBC pieces, some of these packages were 90% good and only 10% bad. But some of these packages were 90% bad and 10% good. And the only person who could possibly know which of the packages was which were the people who had chopped them up, sliced them up, diced them up, repackaged, and put them all together. And that is why the banks themselves discovered that they had played a game of liar's poker that had essentially landed them in a situation that I really do not think that, you know, they perceived. Yes, they were getting all their money out. They knew the bubble had to end. But all of a sudden, what they discovered was these large lending operations at the top of the credit pyramid, the big lenders have to be lending to one another, and they have to trust one another. And they essentially stopped doing that. That was when things froze up in the fall of 2008. All of a sudden, at the top of our credit pyramid, the big lenders are totally unwilling to trust one another and lend to one another. And the reason was quite simple. The CEOs of all the big Wall Street banks went to their own securitization departments and they said, how do I know that this other big bank isn't going to be the next Bear Stearns, you know, in the newspaper the next morning, or the next Lehman Brothers? I mean, is it safe to be lending to them? And what their own securitization department said was, no, it's not. Because there's no way for you to know whether they are sitting there with incredibly toxic securities on their books or whether or not they're sitting there. And then the CEO would ask his own securitization department, because they're all 30 years younger than him and he had no idea what they were doing all along. He'd say, well, how? Why? And they said, because we know they can't tell about ours. And you can't tell about theirs. That was the freeze-up. And that essentially posed the dilemma when first the Bush administration came in and then the Obama administration after. So how do we clean this up? And the idea is, well, we'll get these toxic assets off the books. Yeah, but nobody knows which one is how toxic. Nobody knows which one actually has a value, and therefore if the taxpayer comes in and buys it, they're buying something at a reasonable price and they will be getting something out of it eventually, and which one is a total fraud. So that was the part that is difficult to understand. How could a 20% default rate because of bad mortgages and all of that, how could that possibly lead to the disaster it did? It was basically part of the incredibly fancy sort of financial instruments that have been created completely out of regulation. The other part of the mystery that's a little difficult to understand is, why were people willing to hold these things? Because the banks created them and sold them to institutional investors all over the world, which is why we dragged the rest of the world's financial system down with us. Why were they willing to hold them? In roughly 2006, a lot of European buyers of these packages from the U.S. Wall Street banks began to get a little nervous. They said to themselves, well, wait a minute, that bubble can't keep going up forever, that housing bubble, that real estate bubble in the United States. So maybe these things are a little bit risky. And here's where Yankee ingenuity, I mean, you just got to admire us. I mean, we are just incredible. Whoa, you think they might be risky. Oh, well, you know what a person does when they think they might have something risky that they want to do? You buy insurance. And that's where AIG came from. They basically, that's what the credit default swap, they were selling insurance policies on this. But somebody forgot that an insurance policy is only as good as the depth of the pocket of the insurer. And since these weren't classified as actually part of the insurance industry, even our lax regulation of insurance didn't apply to this. So AIG didn't have to keep anything. They kept nothing, literally nothing, you know, in pocket in order to pay off on these things. But there was the illusion of insurance, and that basically meant that the rest of the world allowed this thing to go on probably a whole extra year. Now, what are the lessons we need to learn? First one, free market finance is an accident waiting to happen. Don't believe me? Ask Eric. Don't believe Eric? Ask Hyman Minsky. Don't ask Larry Summers. Don't ask Timothy Geithner, because they think free market finance is the best thing since sliced bread. Asset bubbles, second lesson. Asset bubbles are seductive for individuals, not just house flippers. A far larger group of home buyers will quite sensibly decide to pay more than they can afford for a house or trade up in order not to be left behind by the real estate bubble. So asset bubbles are incredibly seductive for individuals. They're incredibly seductive for central bankers. Don't want to prick that bubble on my watch. Let the next chairman of the Federal Reserve be the one remembered for sort of the coming down of the bubble. Keep it going. But probably even more importantly, asset bubbles are not a good substitute for productive investment. What have we essentially done with our savings over the past three decades? Well, it's the financial sector that basically decides where are those savings funneled into in terms of investment. They funneled into a dot-com bubble. They funneled into a housing bubble. None of it went into the things that we really need to have investment in. So asset bubbles are both seductive, and they are ultimately no substitute for the kind of real investment we need. Perverse incentives will generate dangerous behavior, and you can bank on it. And there's just a list there. When banks no longer hold the mortgages that they're responsible for deciding, is this a worthy lender, when they can just sell it off immediately, why would they bother to see if the lender was worthy or not? Rating agencies and accounting firms that put AAA ratings on these securitized debt instruments, who paid them? The banks! So the rating agency is hired by the bank to rate these assets of the banks. You think the bank's going to pay their bill if they don't give them the ratings they want? I mean, this is an incredibly perverse incentive. It's hard to imagine how anybody could have ever thought that that was a good idea. I wrote an essay on discounting black swans as the basis for hedge fund profits. It is, but it's regardless of the fact that it's an incredibly dangerous for the financial system as a whole. Okay, what's the fourth lesson? So the third lesson is the entire system was rife with a set of perverse incentives that any competent economist can look at and say, holy cow, this is going to work out badly. It could not possibly work out any other way. Fourth, Lord Keynes was right about finance. A capitalist financial industry has to be regulated. He was right about it back 80 years ago, and we have essentially unlearned that truth in the mainstream of the economics profession, and certainly our politicians have unlearned that truth, along with some very handsome campaign contributions coming from the financial industry if they would just decide to be a little, to go through amnesia. Unfortunately, a real historic opportunity has probably now been squandered. And I'm talking about a historic opportunity that the Obama administration had when it came in. They could either continue the Paulson-Bush option of just throwing money at the banks and essentially paying them to sort of buy up one another and reconstitute an even more oligopolistic, highly concentrated, financial sector than we had before this crisis began.
Ooh.
They could do that. That was what the Bush administration started to do. On the question of regulation, they could either actually, after figuring out how to get credit flowing again, they could have sat down and tried to figure out serious regulation reform for the financial sector. And there was a chance. I mean, I was one person who thought they might be serious about that. As much as I don't agree with Paul Volcker about a lot of things, there is somebody who does know that you have to regulate the financial sector. And he was the one that Obama, right at the election time, said, now he's going to be the head of my commission on regulatory reform, and this is going to be serious. Take a look at the regulatory reform that they proposed. Have you heard Paul Volcker's name any place in the last 6 months? Instead, Summers and Geithner wrested that control over that entire agenda. Certainly, I'm sure, with a lot of influence coming from Wall Street and the donors to the Obama campaign. But essentially, there is no serious regulatory reform on the agenda anymore. Wall Street has managed to, incredibly, a year after the worst financial crisis in 80 years, and Wall Street has already managed to wheedle their way out of any possibility of serious financial regulatory reform as things stand right now. The other alternative was, and the one that would have been far cheaper, and there's plenty of precedents for, was they basically could have taken over these banks, either temporarily or permanently, and they could have appointed new management, and they could run those banks for a period of time as public lending institutions, and that opportunity, had that been done, or if we could still push them to do that, here is what there is to benefit from it. When we own those lending institutions, when the government then we can direct where the investment goes. Everybody knows who's worried about the environment that we need to have a massive investment in new energy sources and in energy conservation technology, a complete makeover of the sort of entire basis for our economy. That's a huge amount of investment that has to go on for many, many years. We could have basically used the financial system to direct our savings into investing in those projects. But it isn't going to happen if you leave it in the hands of the people that robbed us in the first place and you simply throw them enough money to get them back on their feet. And then you say, well, we wouldn't want to interfere in their decisions because everybody knows they are the smart guys who make the smart, intelligent decisions. And the government would certainly have a terrible idea if the government was in some way playing a role in deciding in what direction and for what purposes our investments or our savings are being loaned out. So let me stop there. And Barbara, it's yours.
I want to approach this from an entirely different direction. I don't want to talk about the structural or institutional causes within the financial services industry for this last collapse. I want to talk about the political reasons. Because if you ask me why this last financial crisis happened, I would say it's because we have a divided working class in this country. And that's what I want to talk about. Because financial crises have been happening. Wall Street has been doing the same damn thing for 200 years. We have had many recessions and depressions in this country since Wall Street first came into being and the whole system of financial services and the public trading of corporate shares has led to one bubble after another. And I highly recommend the short, sweet book that John Kenneth Galbraith wrote called A Short History of Financial Euphoria. Because it will it's delightful. It's you can read it in 2 hours, and it basically gives you the background that you need to realize this is just one more of the same. This is not unique. This is not the worst by a long shot, and it's not going to be the last. And the reason it happened is because there was not a political force in this country to prevent it from happening. We may not know all we need to know about what the hell a credit default swap is, but what we do know is that Wall Street and bankers are going to screw us if we let them. So what we need to do to prevent that from happening is put certain political blockades in their way to keep that from happening. There have been only two times in American history when we have been able to overcome what. How many of you heard Noam Chomsky last night? Okay, good. Remember how he talked about the democratic deficit that was built into our Constitution by Madison and friends? That democratic deficit was essentially an institutionalized way to keep the rabble, the property-less working class, from taking away the property of the propertied classes. In an earlier life, I was a lawyer, and one case that I loved was I was representing the Berkeley Tenants Union way back in the 70s. We actually had a rent control law that we passed in Berkeley. It went to federal court being challenged by the landlords, and the federal judge said, you cannot pass a rent control law by initiative because the tenants will always outnumber the landlords, and therefore it's unfair. Let that sink in. So you have essentially a political system. Read your Constitution. Read it carefully, because it is a political system set up to protect private property. And as I started to say, there were two moments in American history when we overcame that democratic deficit. One of them was in the populist era, following another Great Depression, when farmers were losing their farms, when workers had no work, and there was a moment when the working class came together and overcame all of the divisions that are thrown in our way, the divisions of race, the divisions of rural versus urban, the divisions of religion, the divisions of geography, all of the regionalism, all of those things for a brief moment in our history were overcome, and we were able to force reforms on Wall Street. And that was the beginning. When we started to control the railroads, we started to control the banks, we started to control the granaries, the things that the instruments that were repressing us at that time. The banks have always been the bad guys. This is not new. Okay, so the next period was the New Deal period. In the Great Depression, the last one, the 80 years ago one that we're all comparing this one to, a quarter of the people of this country were out of work. And where were they? They were on the streets. There was a militant, united, working class. There was a labor movement that was insisting on change, significant structural change. There was a Communist Party. I'm sorry to mention that in a world that will not admit that. But that was actually living through a process of uniting around certain demands, like how about an 8-hour day? How about Social Security? How about unemployment insurance? And that people were on the streets and they were sitting in factories demanding the right to organize labor unions. And so we passed laws that allowed labor unions to be formed and allowed the working class to actually participate in the governance of not only the political institutions of this country, but the financial institutions. Controls were put on Wall Street. We put the SEC in place, the Securities and Exchange Commission. We put the Glass-Steagall Act, the one that Bill Clinton eliminated for us, that divided commercial banks from investment banks. Those were all done during the New Deal era because Franklin Roosevelt and the Democratic Party didn't dare not do them. They were afraid of a revolution. Literally, they were afraid of a revolution. So what's happened? How do we end up in this mess? Who do we make fun of every day? The teabaggers. Rush Limbaugh, right? We're making fun of the other half of the working class. It's not the bankers we're criticizing. It's not they who get our goat every day. It's those other people who are upset about what's going on Wall Street and what's going on in Washington, D.C. They are as pissed off at Tim Geithner and Larry Summers as Robin Hahnell is. And yet we can't speak the same language as they can. We don't like them. We don't want to be anywhere near them. We are divided by culture, race, gender, religion, all of those things. And yet we have the same economic interests. They don't trust Wall Street. They don't trust the corporations, and they don't trust the Obama administration to do right by them. Okay? Now, are they being manipulated? Sure. Are we being manipulated? You bet. So it is time that we actually take a political look at who's responsible for letting this happen and figure out how to get beyond it. We might regulate our way out of this one. We probably will. The banks are happy. We'll, you know, maybe find a job, maybe won't find a job. But we're not going to change the dynamic until we focus. And that's all I want to say, because I want you guys to have 10 minutes left to actually participate in this discussion.
Try and make your questions brief, concise.